on to our biography segments. Today, cultural and scientific historian Kate Hannah from Auckland University, who has recently published a new entry in the New Zealand Dictionary of Biography about New Zealand botany sensation Nancy Adams. Kate's in the Auckland studio with me now. Hi.
Hi, Jesse.
Nice to see you.
Nice to see you. I have thought of my breakup song, so I'll tell you later.
No, you can tell me now. Go on.
It's got to be In Between Days by The Cure. So I know that's very gothic, sad, and 90s kid of me, but you know.
Because my breakup song is a Cure song as well. But I wasn't going to mention it because I just had to check the lyrics to make sure it actually was a breakup song. You know, sometimes a song makes you sad and then you listen to the lyrics and go, actually, this is about something totally different. Yeah, Close to Me by The Cure.
That is also a good one.
The Cure is just a breakup band, really, aren't they?
I feel like they might be.
Okay, you were in here a couple of years ago, and can you recall what we were talking about last time?
Yeah, I guess we were sort of talking about the beginning of this project or where this biography has come from, which is this idea that women have been left out of the history of science, more broadly internationally, but particularly in New Zealand, because of the ways in which we write about science and some of the techniques that people tend to use and the people who are involved.
Because of the ways we write about science?
So in New Zealand, we have a tendency when writing about science in the past to focus on great men. That's a little bit of a international tendency, but I think it's more prevalent in New Zealand, perhaps because we have a smaller, shorter European or Pākehā colonial scientific history. And so we focus on these kind of figures who transformed or changed or introduced science, Western science, to New Zealand. And because that's only in the last sort of 200 years, it's really easy for people to feel quite personally connected to those figures. So we have a lot of people who feel quite personally connected to the legacy of someone like Rutherford or the legacy of those early colonial pioneering scientists because they're related to them or because they maybe were even taught by them or taught by people who were taught by them. So there's a sort of whakapapa of science in New Zealand that ends up being that people feel quite personally engaged with those stories. Now, that's a really good thing because it means they keep documents and archives and letters and write down what experiences they had or how they knew that person. But it also means that it's harder for them to be objective or not that pure objectivity is possible, but it's harder for them to try and be objective because of this relationship that they have with the person they're writing about.
And now, women are underrepresented in science in 2019. Presumably, they were underrepresented in the 18 and 1900s as well. And are you saying that they are underrepresented even given that?
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. So they're not as underrepresented now in 2019 as we are led to believe. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of women, particularly in undergraduate and graduate programs and working in science jobs, but perhaps not in those professorships that are the most visible top-level attainment in science. And the same thing, we see the same thing in the past. So actually, when we look back, there are much more women than we think there were because their achievements and their presence there is actually obscured by the ways in which we write about science.
I can't remember if I told the story on air yet, but I said to my 8-year-old at breakfast the other morning, I talked to a scientist yesterday and she said, who was she? And I thought, yes, I've done something right.
You've been getting all the right people on.
I guess so. So today we're here to talk about Nancy Adams, and you've contributed a biography of Nancy in the New Zealand Dictionary of Biography. And can you just explain what that dictionary is, what it's for, how long it's been around, where people might find it?
Okay, so it's an online dictionary of biography. It is maintained and developed by the Ministry of Culture and Heritage, so it is sort of a national program of memorialising and making sure that particularly researchers and school kids, etc., have access to finding out about people, important people from New Zealand's past. The first wave of writing the biographies happened in the 1950s. Some of the biographies that are still available online date from the 1950s, and you can tell they date from the 1950s. But there's been a neat program in the last few years thinking about things like women's suffrage 125 celebration last year, and also the 250th anniversary of that we're looking at this year of the encounter between Cook and Tuaia. You know, commemorating and writing about people who perhaps have been left out of those original biographies of key New Zealanders.
I see it says explore the life stories of over 3,000 people who shaped our culture and history. Has anyone crunched the numbers on how those 3,000 people are made up or break down?
I really should have, shouldn't I? But I haven't yet.
It might be too depressing a project, but we're making progress.
We are making progress. So I think 10 science biographies were commissioned in the last 18 months, and I know that at least 3 or 4 of them were of women, which is great, considering that we were looking at people who'd, whose impact was in the sort of 60s through to the 1980s and 90s.
So what led you to Nancy Adams?
I'm a really big fan of Nancy because she comes to science through a kind of checkered pathway, non-standard. And she comes from a background as a botanical artist into being this amazing with this sort of a sense of what they call systemic botany. So she classified and understood the botanical specimens in a deep and amazing way that it's just quite astounding for somebody who ended up not going to university and did all of her scientific training on the job working for the DSIR. And so I really love, as a cultural historian, material culture, like the bits of the past that we can touch and feel and hold. And you can go and look in the Te Papa archives, Nancy's archives, and you can see these beautiful little sketches, just little bits of paper that all the bits that would have been on her desk when she died. You know, there's these wonderful little illustrations and pieces from her childhood. You can really see her personality through her art. And so she just really appealed to me. So when
it's an interesting sort of juncture of art and science, isn't it, Bonnie?
Yeah, it really is. And it's a really interesting one for women because in that kind of 19th century gentrified mould of what women were allowed to do or kind of where middle class and upper class women were allowed to operate, collecting plants and drawing were two things that were very much encouraged for sort of nice girls. And so botany became a thing that girls were allowed to do. Yeah. And they, you know, became incredibly skilled and talented in it. And so Nancy's not the only one, but she comes through at this time, the right age to succeed in a scientific career because of the Second World War, when all the men were, you know, being called up. She got an opportunity at the DSIR and then continued and learnt and became this, you know, outstanding scientist. Like her book about seaweeds is still something that marine biologists use every single day. I mean, I don't know if you picked up on the Twitter conversation that was happening earlier today. So a lot of the marine biologists that I interact with on Twitter, they'll say, have you got your Nancy? So the book is, you know, you call it your Nancy.
Oh, great.
Tracy Farr, who's a wonderful novelist as well, talked about how she's got had her nice one, which is the one that you keep in the office. And then, I don't know if it was naughty. Was it the naughty Nancy? I'll have to check. Naked Nancy. That's why I liked it. That's the one that you take out of the dust cover and keep in a plastic bag and take on the boat.
Ah.
So, you know, she has this presence. Maybe it's particularly for women in science, but, you know, she tells the story and this object that she created that, you know, was published in 1994, which was her life's work, really, which is Seaweeds of New Zealand, where there were sort of 600 species identified, over 450 illustrations that she had done completely herself. I mean, it's an outstanding body of work.
Have you got a moment to, if you can, tell us about the importance of a drawing versus a photograph and why we bother drawing things?
Absolutely. So I guess photographs, I think of them as being more like, if you think about the difference between an aerial photograph as a tool for looking at an environment versus a map, a topographical map. And so the aerial photograph flattens things and it doesn't have that topology that you'd see on a well-drawn topographical map. And so that's what we see in botanical drawing too. It gives us the three-dimensionality of the object and it allows us to be really delicate with things like colour and texture. So if you think about the way that pen and ink drawing or watercolour, which is what a lot of botanical drawings are done in, gives that delicate texture, which is really important, particularly when you're looking at some of those perhaps less charismatic plants like algaes and seaweeds and lichens, textural change and very, very small variations in colour change, those sort of greens to greys, are incredibly important. And because a photograph can't be lit from within in the same way a drawing can be lit from within, you get a lot of glare and you can't get that level of depth. So it's that sense of perspective, and I always think about it like topology, you know, three dimensionality.
Great, good
that
answer.
That it gives.
And might New Zealanders, people listening, have come across her drawings if they're not marine biologists?
Absolutely. So she worked on a number of very important books. Probably the one that people would know the best, and I imagine that lots of people, at least lots of people my age's parents would still have, would be Trees and Shrubs of New Zealand, which was a collaboration with Lindsay Poole, or Alec Poole. He was mainly known as Lindsay. So Nancy did all of the illustrations for that, but that's a text that, you know, every gardener, every person who liked trees, every fanatic bushwalker, all of those parts that make up New Zealand culture, had or has. And so I think people would be very familiar with her plates and illustrations
Would it be Eagle's Complete Trees and Shrubs of New Zealand?
Is that the new edition of it? Oh, I can't see.
No, that's Audrey Eagle.
Oh, it's Audrey Eagle. No, it's not that one.
Maybe someone else.
That is another good one, though.
Okay, I'll find it. Oh, yeah, here we go. Here we go. Still available on Fish Pond by the looks of things.
Good old Fish Pond.
Yeah. December 1994, a field guide for use by students, botanists, ecologists and others.
Yeah, so there's been a lot of editions of it and it is very much used.
If you've just tuned in, Kate Hannah is in. She's a cultural and scientific historian, and she's written the biography of a botanist, a botanical artist called Nancy Adams. So who was she? Where'd she come from?
So Nancy was born in 1926 in Levin in the Horowhenua, and moved to Wellington when she was a child. And it's an interesting story. So her parents separated when she was quite young, but her mother was a Jessie Whittaker of the Whittaker's chocolate fame. And so she grew up surrounded by, in her grandparents' home, the Whittaker's home in Brooklyn, surrounded by her mother's younger siblings, younger brothers. So she had sort of these three teenage uncles who helped bring her up. So it was a really warm and loving family, despite this separation, which was relatively unusual in the 1930s. And she grew up learning all about trees and shrubs and plants from her father's side of the family, supported by her mother's side of the family, but also drawing. And as I said before, the archives that you can see of hers at Te Papa, there's a lot of her juvenile work. And, I mean, some of them are just stunning. Pieces done between the ages of 12 and 14. Mm. Beautiful. I imagine they must have been imagined modernist interiors. I can't see where a 13-year-old girl would have got a magazine that would have these types of modernist interiors.
Yeah.
So a really spectacular eye for colour and design. You know, we're talking really 1930s modernism at a time when that was the newest kind of furnishing style that was around.
Mm.
So she was clearly always looking and observing.
You didn't think it was just from the inside of her house in Brooklyn?
Well, it could have been, but they would have been very cool people if they'd had furniture that cool.
I don't know if news travelled that fast in the 1930s.
I don't know if it did.
Yeah.
And so her use of colour, again, when she was a child, was just beautiful. And so there's this really interesting sort of question about why she didn't go down a purely artistic route, because she was supported. She went to night classes at Wellington Technical College when she was at high school and had a fantastic art teacher at high school at Wellington Girls College as well. And yet she seemed to really want to go into this kind of botanical route. So even though we don't have a lot of records of who her science teachers were or why she got into science, apart from her own statements that she said, I just always knew that something to do with drawing and trees was going to be what she did. She knew that from a young age.
Can I ask, did you go in there head first into the Te Papa Nancy Adams archive?
Yeah.
How was that?
It's just really cool.
Physically, what is it?
Well, it's just a whole bunch of folders. You sit in the very archival work is, it's like field work, but it's really, really quiet and you can't eat or drink. Mm. So it's quite...
Is it in Te Papa, the building?
No, so it's in the Te Papa archives, which are off-site up by the other museum where the old Dominion Museum site was. Mm. And so it's very quiet. You sit there and you go through folder after folder, but When I went through them last year, they hadn't been categorised since they were acquired. So it was really, I sort of did some sorting and talked through with the archivist about what was going on there, and I will go back into them. But they were, it was everything from her desk. So photographs, sketches, the original colour plates from books, a huge array of different things, and just a wonderful treasure trove of images.
So a bit of a sense of her life with her mum and her teenage uncles. But then on her father's side, there was a history of science, I think?
Yeah, so her grandfather, her father's grandfather was one of the early amateur botanists. And so there was very much this, you know, culture in late 19th, early 20th century New Zealand of men who would be usually not trained in science, but with a scientific mind or bent, doctors and solicitors and that sort of thing, who would go for bushwalks and they'd collect things because obviously you could still find new things, or new at least to Western science things in New Zealand at that time.
Yeah.
And there was this great sense of discovery and exploration. I mean, obviously they weren't discovering or exploring anything. Those things were already known, but just not back at Kew Gardens, which is where people would send samples to be categorised. And so, yeah, Adams was her great-grandfather, who was actually, interestingly, colourblind. So some of his specimens that he found, discovered, must have been quite hard for him to spot.
Okay.
Yeah.
So a bit of the science around there. And then did she have people supporting her and mentoring her in the art side of things?
Yeah, so she, as I said before, she went to Wellington Technical College Knights classes, and Fred Ellis, who was a World War One veteran, who came to New Zealand from the UK after his war, was a really wonderful classical trained artist and also stained glass window maker. Mm. So listeners in Wellington will know the Hunter Building at Victoria University College. So Fred Ellis designed the stained glass windows that are in there, which are stunning stained glass windows, but in that very traditional style. So she was very traditionally academy, I think we call it, trained in that observation and design and drawing. And so one of the things I found fascinating about her was that, when we were talking about the difference between photographs and botanical drawings as a resource for scientists before, Nancy never drew from photographs. She drew from specimens or from observation. So even her process as a botanical artist was incredibly scientific because she had to have the actual object there to be able to turn it round, see it in its three dimensions.
Was it unusual for a young woman to go to university in those days? It would have been 1930s, 1940s?
There were, at that, so when you look at the data for the New Zealand universities, there were probably about 5 to 10% of each intake each year across the whole of the University of New Zealand was female. It did rise in 1939, 1940, et cetera, et cetera. So it was relatively unusual. She did start at Victoria University College studying botany and zoology, but she was unwell for a period of time and then went into this job at the DSIR in 1943.
Not a bad place to land.
Yeah, the anecdote, which is delightful, is that the director of the botany division, you know, had this 16-year-old girl in his office and pointed out the window and said, "Name all of those trees." She named all of the trees. And then he said, "Choose one, draw it." She drew it. "Right, you've got the job."
Wow. At just 16.
Yeah, it's pretty full on thinking about it, but it was a different time.
Right, and presumably a bit of a labour shortage as well with the men off at war.
A huge labour shortage. So she was thrown straight into, as I said, the botany division, working for a senior woman in science, Lucy Moore, who was one of the senior people in the botany division, who was a specialist in seaweeds. And so it was through working for Lucy, who was sort of 20, 25 years older than Nancy, that she learned about seaweeds and started understanding how to classify and categorise seaweeds.
That's quite amazing that she started doing that at the beginning of her career in the early 40s, and then the seaweed book came out. What did you say then?
1994.
Right.
Yeah. It was the culmination of her life's work, that book.
DSIR isn't around anymore.
No. So it got split into what we now call the Crown Research Institute.
Yeah.
So I guess the botany division is in Manaaki Whenua Land Care Research. And they still have wonderful archives and herbarium and places where you can go and look at the specimens that people like Nancy and her predecessors collected to be those definitive specimens of a particular plant.
Mm. Do we know much about her years at the DSIR, what it was like for her as a young woman in that environment?
We've got some interesting sort of interviews with both Nancy about that time and also other women who worked in other divisions of the DSIR in the 1940s. And there's this kind of really interesting disconnect. So they'll say things like, oh gosh, everyone was very kind to me and there was never any sexism. And then in the next breath they'll say, but then all the men came back from war and they were very grumpy that we'd taken their seats and we had to have our tea in the other room. Yeah. And so there's this sort of, you go, oh, feels a little bit like there might have been a little bit of sexism.
Okay.
But I think in general she enjoyed herself but was felt quite constricted by her role as a technician and obviously with the brain she had wanted to have more opportunities to expand. But the way that the structure was, she didn't have those opportunities. So when the job came up at the Dominion Museum, which is in 1959. So she was still quite a young woman, only in her 30s.
Actually, before we get to that, we've got some nice audio here from the Sound Archives. So thanks to the team from Ngātanga Sound and Vision. This is actually from a 1994 interview, but it's Nancy talking about her career with DSIR and a book that she'd just published, one we were talking about on seaweed.
But as she says, the seaweeds covered represent most of what we have round our shores, but not all.
Most, yes, because we still don't know what we have in the sea. But most of the common seaweeds and some of the less common ones are treated.
You say also, and this surprised me, that there are large stretches of our coast that are imperfectly known.
Yes. Collecting on around Westport.
Simply because it's difficult physically to gather the
difficult
material.
Difficult and dangerous, yes. I've been there twice and it's been impossible to get. The surf has just been rolling in for miles. And the beaches have had absolutely nothing on them, no drift, which surprised me very much.
What does that suggest?
I don't know.
Is it conceivable that if there are stretches of coastline that are imperfectly known, to use your word, that there are species there yet to be discovered?
Probably.
That could be confined to a fairly small local area?
There are some seaweeds that are confined to fairly discrete areas, but on the whole there is a fairly well defined pattern of distributions according to temperature and topography and so on.
How much has that distribution been impacted by, again, human intervention, beginning with whalers and sealers and later shipping?
Well,
we have
got some introduced seaweeds that almost certainly came as the result of careening wooden ships in the fjords and some of the southern harbours, Stewart Island, Otago Harbour, Banks Peninsula and Kaikoura. And now we think the Marlborough Sounds in the days of early shipping.
Seaweeds, in other words, that had come from the other side of the world, possibly.
Yes.
It's Nancy Adams in an interview in 1994. Had you heard her voice before?
Yeah, I had. She's got that voice of women of that generation from New Zealand, hasn't she? She sounds like my grandmother.
And mine too.
Yeah.
Do you know much about her personality?
I've talked to people about her. When you look at if people have an opportunity to look at some photographs, she clearly had a fantastic sense of style of her own. So she had long dark hair parted in the middle all her life.
Got a picture on the website, by the
yeah,
way. rnz.co.nz/jessie, yeah.
And so in the sort of 1940s and 50s, she kind of looked quite dowdy and unstylish because that's when women all had hair like the Queen. But then she gets into the 60s and 70s and she's a little bit older, but she suddenly looks really cool again because she always wore vibrant, stylish colours and with this eye for design that she had. But she didn't suffer fools. People thought she was quite stern, some people, but she was incredibly loving and popular friend. So she had these wonderful friendships throughout her life with people she worked with at the DSIR and people she worked with at the museum. Obviously, when you go away and do field work in those rough conditions that Nancy was just talking about, trying to gather seaweed off Westport, you know, you're on boats and you're in your togs, and then there's all sorts of hilarious 1970s photographs of men with great big beards drinking beer and Nancy there, you know, who would have been slightly older than all of them, getting stuck in trying to get the seaweed. So she clearly was quite a lot of fun.
Mm. You're about to tell me that she joined the Dominion Museum in 1959.
Yes. So I think when she went to the Dominion Museum, which was at the time less hierarchical than the DSIR was, even though obviously museums have their hierarchies. She was originally there as an illustrator and as a botanical artist, but she had access to all of the botanical archives. And so she went through and did this body of work going through the collectings of John Buchanan, who was one of these other very important early botanists in New Zealand. And so she reclassified and recategorised a lot of his work with this understanding of systemic botany that she had. She could see that a lot of things had actually been incorrectly labelled and incorrectly assigned. Mm. And so in doing that, she kind of established herself in the museum as, oh, she's not just the person who draws the pictures, but she actually has these amazing skills. And that's when she had the opportunity to start working on the books. And so those were those first collaborations, Plants of the New Zealand Coast, which was with Lucy Moore in the 60s, Trees and Shrubs of New Zealand. And also at that time, you know, that's when she was awarded the Loda Cup for her environmental protection and conservation work. And that was because she did a lot of the early illustrations that were used on the covers of pamphlets for dock huts and walks. And again, sort of shows her style and the kind of person she was. And this is 1960, so she would do beautiful, very contemporary looking lino cuts that were used on the covers. And I swear that some of them were still in use in the 1970s and early 80s when people like me were being taken to dock huts by their parents because they look very familiar to me when I see them.
Yeah, I was going to ask you what media she used. So lino cuts?
She was incredibly diverse. So pen and ink drawing and watercolours is the most usual for botanical art. But when you look through the, she produced all of her own Christmas cards, always made beautiful little notes and drawings for friends as gifts. She would, again, so lithographs, lino cuts, printmaking. The only thing I haven't seen a lot of is oil work, but basically any other technique, Nancy would use it.
Through the 60s, as she continued, and then an even more specialised role in marine botany in 1969.
Yeah, and that was sort of the point. You know, that's a really remarkable achievement. It's unusual enough for it would have been unusual enough for a man without university training who'd come in as a technician to then, you know, get to that point of being appointed the chief curator and scientist at the National Museum. But here was a woman being appointed to this role without that kind of protection of the university background. And it was because of the quality of her work. Her understanding was so deep and unique.
But then she also did some work on alpine plants too.
Yeah, so, I mean, the alpinic stuff, that's lichens and algae and things, there's a lot of interrelation with seaweed because it's that very small amount of variation, but actually each individual species. And the ones we have in New Zealand are so unique and unusual that this was very much novel work, categorising them and understanding them.
I guess she's interesting because her skill seems to be so multifaceted. So one thing to draw or paint these things, another one to identify them and recognise their scientific value, and then she was out there actually grabbing them.
Yeah, I think that perhaps is why we had so many amazing botanists and people working in marine biology and other related spaces during that time in New Zealand, because we did have such a small population. We did have to expect people to be able to do nearly everything themselves. And so all of these people, women and men together, expected that they were going to have to go and find their own samples and would have been horrified to be given a sample by somebody else. It's like, well, you know, I didn't collect it. I didn't identify where it was from. So her notes and logbooks are just fantastic. They're so detailed and just, you know, you can learn so much about each expedition by reading her notes.
Can you tell us a bit about her final years?
So she had to retire in the 1980s. New Zealand used to have a rule about 40 years of public service, and once you'd completed your 40 years of public service, people had to retire.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and so she was only 60, and I think it was quite devastated from the people I've spoken to. And so you can see that was in the 80s, and it was a good 11 years later that her life's work book, you know, Seaweeds of New Zealand came out. So she obviously wanted to and did continue to work. She had a sort of an honorary appointment at the museum, which meant she still had access to a lot of the resources in the archives and the herbarium, etc. And so during that time, she kept a really close relationship with a lot of the other women she'd mentored and supported in her time at the museum in the 1970s and 1980s, so had really deep and close friendships. She was very famous for giving their small children peanut slabs, because of course she was Whittaker's peanut slabs family, which was very cool.
And is some of the drawings, like, because they were so fine, did they end up as being treated like artworks in some circumstances?
So there were two exhibitions, one that was held just after her retirement as a retrospective, and then one that was held just before her death, of botanical drawings, which actually went around the country. I think there's definitely space to review it, walking away from thinking about them merely as scientific drawings and thinking about them just on the artistic merit. I've been secretly thinking about an exhibition would be a really cool thing. There's just such a rich resource of her work, and it tells us a story of women's lives in the 20th century that, you know, is kind of personal but political and all sorts of other things at the same time.
Kate says that Nancy worked with her dad, Ross O'Rourke, another remarkable human, and she'd pick him up each morning and drive him home. She'd gift our family boxes of Whittaker's peanut slabs and Santee bars wrapped in wax paper. And she lived with her mother in Karori, Wellington. I remember her garden vividly, says Kate. It was so whimsical, with hidden nooks and crannies for a little girl to explore. Nancy, Kate remembers, was a very straightforward woman, not particularly warm to children, but respected by all. Do we know much about her family life? Did she marry? Did she have children?
No, so she didn't marry. And that's, I guess, why I think about her as being kind of sort of emblematic of that women's lives in the 20th century. So there was a relationship with an American serviceman during the war, and he died. And then immediately post-war in the later 1940s, she was engaged for a brief period of time to a young man who was a doctor, and he was really tragically killed, giving aid at the site of an accident on the side of the road. And so, you know, on one level you can look back and go, her parents' marriage broke up, she didn't go to university because she'd been ill, these sort of sadnesses that happened, this grief and this pain that was part of her life. But she very much chose to view her life as something that she had enjoyed and was, you know, she looked forward to the things that were worth looking forward to. And so her relationship with her mother and her mother's family, those uncles who'd been only a few years older than her when she was growing up, remained incredibly close and strong. And she was very, you know, their children were part of her life. And she was very much, that example from the listener, Kate, is very much what I've heard from other people whose parents worked with Nancy, or women who worked with Nancy, about their children being part of a wider group of people that Nancy viewed as being part of her extended family and friends.
She's been remembered and recognised in various ways by the Queen.
Yes.
And I think she's had a couple of things named after her as well.
Yeah, so there's the Adams Herbarium at Manaaki Whenua is named after Nancy Adams, and she was recognised by the Queen with the Queen's Service Medal or Order in a year that
yeah,
I can't remember.
Queen's Service Order, and then the following year, a 1990 commemoration medal.
That's right, the good old sesquicentenary.
Sesquicentenary medals. Jeez, I wonder who else got those.
There were quite a few, because the 1993 women's suffrage anniversary was close by, so there was a big sort of flurry of celebrating.
The 1990 commemoration medals, yeah, okay.
Jesse and I having a little flashback
now
to school days.
Yeah, Ricky Morris, Nikki Jenkins, the big names in 1990.
Yeah. So she was recognised, and that's one of the other things too, is that it's good to go back and look at how we might not... People might not be as familiar with her now, but actually at the time she was getting celebrated and recognised, and people were writing newspaper articles about her. And she was, you know, New Zealand Gardener magazine wrote a beautiful biography of her when she died, because she was incredibly important to generations of New Zealand gardeners. So she was known, but then what happened after she died? Why did she disappear from our remembrances in the kind of academic scientific history circles?
Great question. Well, she's not forgotten any longer. Kate has written her biography, which you can find on teara.govt.nz. That's the home of the Dictionary of New Zealand Biography. We've been talking about Nancy Adams. And thanks so much, Kate.
That's all right, Jesse. Lovely to be here.